The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Larry Kudlow yesterday, pending the agreement that was ultimately reached on the aid package in the Senate, was asked, well, if the president is putting April 12th, Easter weekend, down as a marker for us to return to something approximating normalcy when it comes to economic activity, then why the need for the $2 trillion aid package? Actually, $6 trillion. As Larry pointed out, there's the $2 trillion on the fiscal side and the $4 trillion on the monetary side. And Kudlow explained why both are needed.
If we can target zones where the virus is less prevalent, things are safe, we're not abandoning the health professionals' advice, but there is a clamor to try to reopen the economy and perhaps I'll call it less of a shut-in. And so that's one piece that's yet to be determined, but it's one piece that's being looked at. We still going to need the assistance because in the next week or two or three, you're still going to have a lot of hot zones. You're still going to have shut-ins. There's no miracle here. We're not just, you know, flipping a switch. So the assistance is so vital. Let me tell you, it's $2 trillion program and $4 trillion of lending power from the Fed. That's a $6 trillion package. And by the way, the Fed can't act fully unless we pass phase two, because phase two contains the increase in the exchange stabilization fund, which is the equity piece for the Fed lending, so that the U.S. government is the guarantor, not the Fed. So those two packages go together. $6 trillion, by the way, is about almost a third of the economy. It's a very big number and covers, as you know, small businesses, payrolls, unemployment, and so forth. So we need that. We need that, and that, in effect, will hopefully, perhaps the word is bolster or maintain the economy.
The size of this is unprecedented, but perhaps the kind of actions being taken really are not. To get a little bit of a historical context to this, we're pleased to be joined by Christopher Shaw, who's author, historian, and policy analyst. PhD in history from UC Berkeley. He's the author of Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. Christopher Shaw, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Dan.
So with respect to the $4 trillion that Larry Kudlow is talking about and the $400 billion that is going to be poured from the Treasury into the Fed's Exchange Stabilization Fund, what kind of precedent do we have for this sort of monetary rescue, or the monetary piece of it being part of the rescue?
I think this is looking pretty unprecedented. I mean, we don't have the text right now. We don't know exactly what's going on. But this is already much larger than the whole bailout of the banks got during the Great Recession after, 2008. So it's already bigger than that. So this is very big, and I think we are in uncharted waters. I mean, what the Fed's doing is just huge here, and it's kind of like the Fed is sort of becoming a bank itself rather than being more of a central bank. It's actually just the way it's lending. It's serving as a backstop for all kinds of money markets and credit in all different directions. So this is definitely something new.
And there's even a talk, although it's been, it's being argued. I mean, there's talk of, it's not included here, but the talk of federal government getting into the business of buying equities to prop up the stock market. And that didn't work out terribly well in Japan, as the Wall Street Journal opined. But it seems to me the problem is, and why you have proposals like that, is the Fed is running out of tools, as in a in an era of virtually zero interest rates and after a decade of quantitative easing?
Yeah, the Fed just doesn't have that many new things it can do. So it's trying out everything it can do. I mean, it's throwing in the whole kitchen sink. A lot of people thought after its initial round that it did last week that it had done everything it could do. And then this week, now they're coming up with a new set of things. So it seems that desperation leads to creativity. And the Fed is responding in kind with all kinds of new ideas. The Fed is getting very, very creative in this crisis we're having right now.
When we come back with Christopher Shaw, I want to talk a little bit about the history of the Fed, which he has written about extensively, and some of the different approaches and different economic crises that have been taken by different administrations throughout American history. I'm talking to Christopher Shaw, author, historian, policy analyst. His book, Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. Back with more.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Back with Christopher Shaw, author, historian, policy analyst, a PhD in history from UC Berkeley. He's the author of the book, Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. Just trying to again, do some comparisons, even though this moment is difficult to do apples to apples to throughout other moments of financial distress in American history. But Amity Schlaes wrote about a different approach that the federal government took in the 1920s, a decade before the recession, which was when there was the prospect of a recession coming on. They actually moved to raise interest rates and cut government spending and reduce taxation rather than some of what has been done in more recent financial crises, including this one now, which is massive Keynesian demand side infusions, both from the Fed as well as from the federal government.
Yeah, so in right after World War I, 1920, 1921, there was a pretty severe, sharp depression that we don't remember very, very well. And it was largely caused by the Fed. This is when the Fed is just getting going. I mean, the Fed had just got up and running in 1914. They really didn't know how to use their monetary tools that well. And so Milton Friedman basically described it as, the Fed saw some inflation. It didn't notice this until too late. And then when it did, it slammed on the brakes too hard, and then it left the brakes on for too long. So then when the Fed finally started easing up and letting the money supply expand in 1921, that depression came to an end pretty quickly. So that was an example of the Fed through mistaken policy, causing a depression, and then figuring it out eventually and curing it. So that's what happened right after World War One.
Well, right. And then into the Great Depression, of course, Milton Friedman wrote a book about this, the Fed deepening the Great Depression and extending it in his mind. And I wonder, looking back at Fed policy there and the arguments that Friedman advanced, among others, if you see us remaking some of the same mistakes?
Well, I think the main mistake that happened in the early 1930s after the Great Crash of 1929 and this big economic slide begins where unemployment is going up and economic activity is going down and it's just going on for years, dragging on that way, is that the Federal Reserve didn't really have a concerted plan as to what to do. Sometimes it's wanting to maintain higher interest rates, and then it made some half-hearted attempts to expand the money supply. But basically, you have the money supply falls by a third or so between 1929 and 1933. And this really fed into a deflationary spiral. And when you have deflation, what you have is people start postponing purchases. They don't want to buy things because they're hoping that the price will go down. When they do that, then this means that stores and shops are selling less goods. This means that you're getting less orders to manufacturers. They start cutting people's hours. They start laying people off. Wages go down. It becomes this really vicious self-fulfilling prophecy. So what you needed to have at that time was to have the money supply expanded, and that is not what happened. So that was a real misstep on the part of the Fed, and it's something that's definitely very much in the mind of Federal Reserve System policymakers these days, and was certainly in mind in 2008, explicitly so, when they're looking at what to do and how to handle these crises that we're living through today.
Take us all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century, after William Jennings Bryan famously would not be crucified upon a cross of gold, arguing against the gold standard. And as you write in your piece at Harper's, wanting money to be controlled by officials responsible to the people and not sort of the titans of finance, and how that informed the ultimate creation of the central banking and policy emanating therefrom.
One thing that people often sort of forget is that the Fed is a political institution. It makes decisions that have ramifications for us all, and, you know, there's winners and there's losers. So it's very political, and you can see this in its origins. And the Fed came into being in 1913 when the Federal Reserve Act was passed, and there was really two competing sides here. One, William Jennings Bryan was probably the leader in those negotiations, and he wanted the Fed to be very much explicitly political. He wanted a central bank to be one that would be accountable to the people. And this is why he insisted on having no bankers choosing who would serve on the Federal Reserve Board, and instead have the members of the Board of Governors be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. On the other side, against him, you had the bankers, especially Wall Street bankers, who've been pushing harder than any other group of bankers for a central bank. They wanted the Fed to be an institution that they would own, that they would operate, and they would also appoint the leadership of it, so they would control it as well. And so this led to this kind of private-public settlement that we have, where the Federal Reserve banks are privately owned. Bankers control and sort of run the Federal Reserve banks themselves, because, you know, there's 12 Federal Reserve banks that are combined together to make the Federal Reserve System. But then the Federal Reserve System is overseen by a board of political appointees. So that is the political origins of the Federal Reserve, and certainly it has been political, ever since.
He is Christopher Shaw, author, historian, policy analyst, PhD in history from UC Berkeley. The book, Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. Christopher Shaw, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.